linguistic
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, today I'm going to play a continuation of the conversation I had with psychedelic pioneer Gary Fisher that I began in last week's program. So I'll dispense with the long introduction that I gave Gary last week and let you refer back to that program to hear a few highlights of his impressive career, and we'll just get right to the rest of our conversation today. Now, in the first part of today's conversation, you're going to hear Gary tell about two encounters he's had with what surely sounds to me like extraterrestrials. And what's so striking to me about these two stories is the fact that it's Gary Fisher, PhD, who is a sober, highly intelligent scientist and one who I greatly admire. And it was only after I'd known Gary for several years that he first told me any of these stories, and they still stop me right in my tracks. If you think back to a few podcasts ago, you might remember that Terrence McKenna was saying that whenever he was confronted with stories like this, the first thing he did was to take a close look at the person telling the story. And then, of course, he went on to tell his own story about a close encounter he had with an alien spaceship. But with Gary, my take on this whole area of inquiry has changed. I only know a very few rare individuals who even come close to Gary in terms of intelligence, experience, and just plain old common sense. So when he started talking about having an encounter with some form of intelligence that most likely is not of Earth origin, well, I pay very close attention. And in fact, his stories have done much to help me keep my mind open when it comes to things like this. To be honest, I'm not really sure what to think. I can say for sure that there was no hint of a prank in Gary's eyes as he told about these encounters, so I believe him completely. But I've got the advantage of knowing and respecting Gary for a long time, so you'll have to be your own judge of these things, but I do think it wise to keep your mind as open as you can when you encounter stories like this. But first we'll pick up kind of in the middle of a story Gary was telling about himself. And it was a time when he had taken a very large dose of LSD, and he had one of those aha moments where he asked his sitter to write down a very important thought. Let's listen.
So finally I said to him, "Bob, come here." And so he came over and said, "What?" I said, "Write this down. It's extremely important." He went, "Oh, okay."
He was sitting for you?
Yeah, he was sitting for me. Because the sitters never took anything. And so I said, "Gary," I said, "never take any of this shit again as long as you live."
That's your note to yourself.
That was a note to myself. And he started to laugh. And he laughed, and he was rolling on the floor laughing. And I thought, what the fuck's funny about that? And then I got it. So I started laughing, and I laughed for forever, you know. But I was like, don't ever do this again.
I think we've all probably been there. We've done it more than twice.
Yeah.
No. Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's still living alone?
Yeah.
And she's, that'd be 95, 96?
96.
96?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That in that big old house. Now, you used to live close to her, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
That you knew Aldous. And,
oh, yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
you went to dinner and all.
Yeah.
That. Any good stories from that?
No.
That are,
what I did want to tell you was that when I there's a psychiatrist by the name of John Rosen, and his book is called Direct Analysis, and he used to get right in there with patients. Amazing man, fearless, totally fearless. Well, I went to see him work with a patient in Scottsdale one time. And so how I got to visit these other people, I don't have the memory of how that connection happened. But these people were testing Edgar Casey's stuff.
Mm.
Do you know Edgar
Casey?
Oh,
sure, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And because Charlie looked on the internet and said that Edgar Casey doesn't have anything to say about aneurysms. And I was very interested in them, and they lived in an old Spanish house. And so, you know, we were sort of chatting. There were a number of people there. And so there was one guy that I kept looking at. And there was something about him that just wasn't right. And there was something amiss. And so finally I went out on the patio because I could never talk to him alone. So I went out in the patio.
This is at Laura's house?
No, at the husband and wife who were studying Casey's stuff in Scottsdale.
Okay.
And so I went out and he came out. And the first thing I said, which I didn't realize I was going to say it, I said, "You're not from this planet, are you?" And he said, "Well, how do you know?" And I said, "Well, I can just tell you're not quite put together physically right." And he said, "Well, nobody ever picks it up." He says, "You're the first person who's ever picked it up." And I said, "You come from Southern..." So I'm getting chills up my spine now. And so I said, "Well, you come from some other planet." He said, "Yeah, we came on a mother ship, and then you're taken down, and you're given a, quote, physical body, so that you can, you know, go amongst people who are studying interesting things." And that's why he was finding out about Casey and all the work they were doing. But so we talked for at least 40 minutes. And that was one of the first time, the only time I ever met a person that I immediately knew was not of this planet.
You just had that sensation.
Mm-hmm.
And he confirmed it, mm-hmm. interestingly.
Yeah. The other time when I was out in the desert and I had gotten telepathic communication to keep going on this trail towards 29 Palms, which I did. And then the car turned over on the side of the road automatically, so I parked there, got out, crossed over, and started walking. And it was getting hot, and so I was uncomfortable. So I sat down under a tree, and all of a sudden I got up, and I got the message, "We didn't tell you to sit down, we told you to keep on going." So my legs just was going, you know, and so I was going with it. And so I could see this thing coming out of the horizon, and it was a light, and it would come like this, and then it would stop. And then there were jets from Edwards Air Force Base that you would see that was coming out, and this thing would just stay and hover in midair.
Like a light ball kind of thing?
Yeah, just like a light. And they would come close, and then all of a sudden the thing would disappear and appear up here somewhere without going there. And then the jets would start approaching them. And so and it would move again. And then I got the telepathic communication, "Well, we're having interference with these jets today, so we can't land, you know, for you today." So
you had a close encounter, and it was almost really close.
Mm-hmm.
Now, an experience like that, I totally decided long ago to keep my mind wide open to these mm-hmm. things because... Mm-hmm. You know, I look at us as like fish, you know, that don't know what water is, or birds that don't know what air is.
Yeah.
We've discovered that we're swimming in 90% of this universe is dark energy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're swimming in something, and mm-hmm. we don't know what's going on. And so I've decided that I have to admit that I don't know about these things, and I've never had this kind of an encounter. But I have talked to other people that have, and they seem very real.
Of course, what activated that memory was you're talking about UFOs and so forth. And funny, sometimes very funny stories. This one guy always wanted to have an experience with a UFO, and he lived out in the desert, out in the low desert. And so he was always very interested in that. And so finally, one night, the TV kept going off, and so he'd turn it on, it would go off, and then the lights would go on and off and so forth. So he thought, well, what on earth is going on? So he checked his electrical box and so forth, and nothing happened. And all of a sudden, there was this light, intense light above his house. And so he went right over to the window, and the spaceship was landing in his yard. And so he ran and got under the bed and said, God, I'll never ask to see another spaceship as long as I live. If you'll have it, just go away. And my kids love that story because they laugh and giggle.
Well, that sounds like me. You know, I heard Terrence McKenna tell a story one time, and he had gotten, by the time I got to go to his workshops, he'd been through the UFO thing where he'd been following them, and then he decided that they're all hoax, and he was into this, check the person that's telling the story. And he went into this whole thing, well, there are people, women in trailer parks who watch daytime TV, and then he goes through this whole thing, and he gets down to the end, and he says, but, you know, the UFO that I saw parked in La Chorrera when we were down there, he said, now that one was real. So, do you have any clue what you think they'd be doing? I mean, why would extraterrestrials come
well,
down?
Well, I asked this guy that question, of course. I said, well, why are extraterrestrials investigating the planet? He said, well, we're trying to find people who have advanced brain development, who can sense different things, and that he says, well, you're one of them, and you're one of these new generation of people. And he said, we are looking for people like that to see if there's enough people like that in any one particular place where we could come down and actually share information that we have. And there's a place in South America that I'd heard about where there are a number of these sightings and this whole group of people that were living down there. But that's been years ago. I don't remember the detail. Yeah, but that's what they were doing.
About the South American and
good.
That within the last few years, there's rumors of some caves that have
yes.
something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's those stories are still current.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
Now, I would assume they'd have to come in as infants and grow their bodies. They couldn't come in fully developed. So they'd have to go through childhood and everything.
No, they can come in and then they take on human form.
Is that like a walk-in that they talk about? Or can they just materialize a human form?
They can materialize in human form. Mm-hmm. That's what this guy did.
Mm-hmm.
He just materialized.
You know, that 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have had this discussion because I was much more of an engineer and in my head. But I think one of my big aha moments in my life about thinking about the beyond actually came a story that you told when we were riding up to Kathleen's salon one time, and you told about when you flew to Mexico and Tim Leary picked you up and you're yeah. driving down and mm-hmm. you stopped and
mm-hmm.
the reason, and I'll have you tell the story so that now I've prepped it so everybody's going to hear it, but the reason that struck me so forcefully is that up until that moment, I had you pegged as a hard-nosed scientist, materialist, rationalist, reductionist.
Mm-hmm.
And because, I mean, you work in that field. You don't mm-hmm. you don't let me get away with much bullshit. I mean, you humor me some. But that was such a disconnect for me to hear somebody whose mind I respect mm-hmm. to talk about reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started really tuning into my own mm-hmm. more. But the story I thought was spectacular, and I've been longing for a lifetime like that one that you had on the beach there.
Yeah, my body all started responding first to all
and
this.
You're riding in the Jeep.
In the Jeep, and I was in the back seat, and all this tingling that was going on in my body was just like, ooh, it was just like on fire. So I yelled at Tim to stop, and so he stopped, because he had come in with the Jeep to pick us up. And so I jumped out of the Jeep and started taking, you know, my clothes off and ran to the beach, looked down at the beach, and that was the exact space that I had been 2 years before in a psilocybin session. And I had been a fisherman there. And I had the most idyllic life you can imagine. It was just wonderful. I fished, I ate fruit, I did nothing, enjoyed the sun. I mean, head was empty. You know, it was wonderful. And then this, during the session, this was with psilocybin, during the session, then this energy came and started pulling me away. And I kept saying, no, 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 I don't want to leave. I want to stay here. I want to stay here forever. So it came a second time, and a third time it just came and shook the shit out of me. So I said, I'm coming, I'm coming. So I went on. But that was all in Zihuatanejo. And 2 years later, that was the place that I had been a fisherman.
The one, the same vision, the same images mm-hmm. that we'd seen on psilocybin.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
Some sort of foreshadowing there. In a movie, that would be foreshadowing, I guess, mm-hmm. in a life it is. Mm-hmm. That another thing, Mary C. and I have these conversations because I keep saying, oh, you know, I really hope there is no afterlife. Cause I'm just tired of being aware. You know, I want to sleep for 3 or 4 billion years, 100 billion years, you know. But I get tired of being aware. And she just laughs and says, well, you can't get out of it. And you mentioned, you said, oh, I can remember my incarnations back to a single-celled organism. I asked you what it was like, and you said, well, boring. But it doesn't sound like the life on the beach was boring, even though it wasn't
right.
a life.
Oh, no, it was wonderful. It was just this wonderful, warm, sunny, gorgeous water. Eat fish and fruit, and basically don't do anything.
So is that what really we humans should be doing, just enjoying the
Well, those
garden?
Are called, you know, in the esoteric world, those are called sleeping karmas. Mm. And you'll run into people. And it's a person who's happy all the time. Everything goes well for them. They don't have any hysterics in their life. And they're having sleeping karmas. Mm. They just come in, to relax.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Maybe the next one we can do this together. I'm all for a little sleeping karma, to tell you the mm-hmm. truth. So that I know you don't really like talking about your days with Tim Leary, so I won't push you too hard on that. But
yeah, we're not probably going to talk about him.
Well, he gets enough people to talk about him. So
yeah.
But around that time, not about him, but of the events that took place, because you were moving around the world with that crew, and that mm-hmm. was really the go-go psychedelic 60s and all. So of that whole milieu that you were in, because you went from academia and research to Zihuatanejo, and then you went somewhere in the Caribbean.
We went, first of all, to Antigua. Ralph and the other people had already gone to Dominica, because this guy told them to come to Dominica because he was doing LSD research. The government was very glad to have them do the research because they were going to use it in their prisons and in their schools and so forth and so on. And so they went to Dominica. And I was getting ready, you know, packing up to go. And so what happened, they got in Dominica, and the Dominican government arrested them all because this guy had said, people from the United States who have lots of money are coming to help overthrow the government. And so that's what they're here for, is to overthrow the government. And of course the guys from, you know, Newton said, what? You know, we're going to overthrow the government? And this guy who was making the contact was crazy as a hoodow. He wanted to overthrow the government. So that was the end of that. So they were pushed out of Dominica right away. And they went across, and the first island was Antigua. And so getting to Antigua was a nightmare. The plane kept breaking down. We had to go to New York, and then we lost part of the luggage in New York going from one terminal through the other. And we had three kids, two kids in diapers.
Yeah.
And so then we finally got to Puerto Rico, and then we had to change planes again. The plane we were getting on blew up as we were going out to it. The thing got on fire.
While you're walking out to it? It's about the time I turn around and go home by boat.
Time to go home, right. So it was weird. So we had a terrible time getting out of Puerto Rico and finally ended up in Antigua. So we arrived there, and we were just exhausted because we'd been flying for hours and hours and hours. And so we got in there, and I said, well, I'm with the group, with Timothy Leary, and if you can call them, they'll come and get us. And he said, oh, no, they're being deported. They're being deported. He says, yes, and you can't come in the country. You have to, you know, take the next flight out. Well, we had no money. You know, no tickets, no money, nothing. And here we were in Antigua. And so finally we just kept sitting there and sitting there and sitting there. And so finally they called the attorney who was representing Leary's group in Antigua, and they came and did something, give them money, I suppose. And then we got our papers to get deported from there. But we got out of the airport and got to the hotel. But, yeah, that was the whole story about Antigua.
So you really didn't spend any time doing research?
Well, we didn't really do anything except nothing. And because the police would come out every day. What's interesting about the police, like the guys would go somewhere during the day. Well, I forget where we would go, but the women would be just left there. And one of the women was pregnant. She was about 8 months pregnant. And so they would come. And so the police chief finally said to them, well, they would keep giving us edicts that you have to be off the island by sundown tomorrow. Sundown would come and we'd still be there. So the police would come out again. And so finally we were gone, the men were gone, and so one of the gals, a pregnant gal, said, well, will you take us to the market? Because, you know, we need to get some food. So they got in the Jeep and went to the market. They took them to all these markets to get food. And so they went to the chief of police and said, these are the nicest people. They always welcome us in. They always make us tea and feed us. And they're wonderful people. And so if you want them in jail, because the jail was full of crazy people. I mean, the jail was like a barbaric place. Mm-hmm. It's all the mentally ill that were there. He says, if you want them in jail, you go get them, and then you take them to jail, because we're not. We all will resign if you instructed us to do it. So,
that's what I would call goodwill ambassadors.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So somebody rounded up the money to get you all up to Millbrook from there, I guess. Right? Or did you come back to California?
No, we went to, from there we went to Guadalupe.
Oh.
And so we were going to settle there. And that never happened. And it's a French island.
Mm-hmm.
And very different than Antigua, which is English. But, you know, we had wonderful experiences. We would get picked up by some black people, get to know us, and then they'd take us to only where black people were doing with these steel drum bands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God, it was just incredible. Beautiful.
Were you guys doing any LSD then, or was it just...
Well, we had a lot of... one of the things I know that happened is that we dug holes in the sand and then buried a lot of it, and then the high tide came in, and we didn't know where it was. So we lost all that.
So there may be some Sandoz vials floating around in the ocean.
And then on one flight that we were on, we had all the stuff stuffed inside children's toys, stuffed bed, and that we were watching the... the escalator go up with the bags, and that one teetered at the top and then fell all the way down, so it all smashed. I was going to Hawaii to work, and so people from L.A., we got all our money together to buy LSD so we'd have a stash of it forever. And the guy from L.A. went to Vancouver, I remember that. He sort of walked across the border. Then he took a flight to Frankfurt, Germany. And then somebody else went from Frankfurt, Germany to Switzerland, and they got the LSD, and they were in the vials. And so this took months and months and months to happen. So by the time I got back to L.A., of course, I was in Hawaii, so they said, we'll just send it. Well, they put it in all this, I don't know, it was a fluffy kind of substance that they put it in, these little vials. I didn't know. I thought the LSD was all at the bottom of the box. So I went into this bathroom, and I still remember the bathroom in this old abandoned hotel in Hilo, a hospital that we used as our headquarters. And I was dumping all of this foaming stuff in the toilet and flushing the toilet. I flushed all the LSD in the toilet. I laughed so hard, I was sore. After all that money and traveling, and I dumped it all down the toilet.
You know, there is a sign that extraterrestrial knew that he had the right guy with you, because only an advanced soul could laugh at something.
Oh, God, that was so hilarious.
Oh. Well, you know, I've found in my life that eventually all of my great tragedies become really funny stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I can shorten the time between the tragedy and the story, the happier my life is. you really cut to the chase on that. Did you ever cross paths with Alan Watts?
Oh, yes.
That he's somebody that really fascinates me.
Did you know him at all?
Oh, of course not. No, I only found out about Alan Watts maybe 20 years ago when I bought a set of his tapes from his son. But I'm a latecomer to this whole thing. Yeah, I'm a Irish Catholic Republican lawyer engineer that was 42 years old before his first psychedelic experience. You were done with all this when I started, so I never had the pleasure of meeting him, but. I've enjoyed his tapes.
But Alan was funny, funny as can be. You know, he was a real comedian. He was a pixie. You know, he was just a pixie. And he and Mary Jane, the woman that he lived with for years and years, had gone to Maria Sabina and had taken the mushrooms. And so Alan said to Mary Jane, because they hadn't been married, they'd lived together for years, that this would be a perfect time to get married. And so they went through the marriage ceremony with Maria Sabina.
Oh, really? Wow.
When they came back to the United States, Mary Jane was just totally cold to Alan and totally turned off to everything, and finally said to Alan, we're going to have to get a divorce because we're totally different people and we have nothing in common and this is never going to work. And so I want a divorce. And so he said, well, we can't get a divorce in this country. He said we would have to go back to Mexico because that's the only place where our marriage is valid. Is our marriage isn't valid in California. And she said, are you sure? And he said, yeah, I'm sure. Never heard a word. She never brought it up again. But just this image, you know, of being married. No.
She couldn't deal with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they lived on the houseboat then.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get up to the houseboat to see him up there?
No, I don't remember. I remember one houseboat in Sausalito.
Well, that's where his houseboat was, Sausalito.
Mm-hmm. Where I'd met him most of the time was at Dennison's house in Hollywood, the house that overlooked the lake. And Henry and what's her name? Ruthie Dennison. Ruthie Dennison now has an ashram out in the desert. And I don't know if Henry died or not, but Alan was just funny. I mean, he was so funny.
That's the first time I've really heard that about him. You know, you hear all his serious talks, but you don't hear the pixie.
Oh, yeah, he was a pixie. And at one dinner, this very proper lady said, "Well, Dr. Watts, what do you hope to gain from your next experience with LSD?" And Alan said, "Another book." You know, just like that. Of course, she was so shocked. Oh, he was funny.
Did he ever meet Aldous Huxley too? I mean, because I know that you and the Huxleys live near each other, so you probably saw them frequently. Did Alan Watts and Aldous Huxley ever get together? You know,
I don't know. I have to ask Laura.
Not with you and there.
No, I don't remember Alan being there. I'm sure he must have been. Yeah, because everybody ended up at the Huxleys.
How did you meet the Huxleys?
I think it was because it was through my mentor, Nick Shawalas, and I think that his entree was from two husband and wife that were alcoholics and had taken LSD in Canada for alcoholism, and it completely dried out and became forerunners of sponsoring LSD. So that's my guess. But I know it was early because I've known Laura for forever. I always remember Aldous was so dry. He had this very English dry sense of humor. And so Aldous said to me, Laura said to me, "Well, Gary, what do you do when you're not busy being a psychologist?" And Aldous said, "Probably enjoys himself." Yeah, he was very, very tall and couldn't see at all.
I heard that. He had real thick glasses.
Oh, yeah, very thick glasses, yeah. There's some wonders. I've got some great pictures of him around somewhere. I don't know where
they are. Someday I'd like to see those.
Yeah. And you've been to Laura's house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know there's pictures of Aldous everywhere.
Right, right, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really an amazing house.
Isn't it?
A lot of you can just feel all kinds of spirits in that building.
Yeah. And Laura's best friend was Ginny Pfeiffer. And Ginny's house burned down when Laura and Aldous's house burned down in that Hollywood fire. Mm-hmm. And so Ginny bought this other house that Laura still lives in. And then shortly after that, Aldous got cancer. So because they were going to rebuild, and they never rebuilt.
Didn't he lose a manuscript in that fire?
Oh, he lost all
his
paper.
He lost everything,
but
one that had been unpublished that he was working on.
Oh, yes, lots and lots and lots of things.
I don't know how you recover from something like that.
Yeah,
Did he get depressed after that, or did he come through?
Mm-hmm. No, he never got... No, he had a tremendously clear awareness. And very British.
Mm-hmm. Proper British gentleman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, he was introduced to... he used psilocybin, I think, didn't he?
Mescaline,
that's right. Mm-hmm. Through Humphrey Osmond, is that how he first?
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard that Al Hubbard brought LSD into his life, too.
I don't know about that. Myron would know.
I think that's what Myron told me. I'll have to go back and check.
Mm-hmm.
But at dinner parties and all, Huxley, was he just quiet or did he put forth?
He was very interesting because lots of people came to visit. And Aldous was extremely inquisitive about everybody. So he would get the person talking about themselves, and then Aldous would ask more questions and more questions until the evening was over and everybody left. And then the people that left would think, "Well, he didn't say anything about himself. He never talked. We did all the talking." But that was his genius. He got everybody to talk. And, you know, have you read the book Island?
Oh, actually three or four times.
Yeah.
And actually, that's the one that I've heard Laura on many occasions tell people that that's the one he considered his most important book.
Yeah,
I've read most of his books, but Island is... And, you know, Ireland doesn't have a happy ending either. You know,
right.
Gunfire in the distance. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that was a very important book. I heard. You know, I've got two groups of friends that relative to Leary that met Leary. The ones that knew Leary when he was Tim Leary, and then those that knew him at the end of his life. And the people that knew him in the last 5 to 10 years that were hanging around his Hollywood apartment or home there are devotees.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody that knew him before he moved to Hollywood mm-hmm. really doesn't want to talk about him too much and mm-hmm. like to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't tell you what's in this paper that Myron wrote, but when you read the comparison that he does of Leary, that you'll laugh out loud, I guarantee. I don't want to ruin it for you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we were having a phone conversation, and I said something to you, because I know how you feel about it, and I said, well, you know, being the devil's advocate here, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation if it mm-hmm. wasn't for Tim Leary. And without missing a beat, you just said, oh, yes, we would. And that shut me up. But I think that the people that knew him in the last 4 or 5 years, he'd either mellowed or something, but they had a decidedly different impression than the people that knew him when he was younger. So,
yeah.
You know, he lived several lives.
Yeah, and of course, you know, at the very end, I drove Laura over to that farewell for him when he was dying. Because I don't remember why, but anyway, that's why I went, because I certainly didn't want to see him. And I really didn't see him. I just said hello, but didn't talk to him. But his son,
I couldn't remember.
Because his daughter was Susie, and of course, she committed suicide mm-hmm. in prison. And that was the first time that he had seen Tim in years and years and years. He had totally, you know, was so angry at him. Because he was a terrible father. Just a terrible father.
Yeah.
Well, he was a drunken Irishman with a silver tongue.
He wasn't a very good husband either.
Oh! How many wives did he have? Four?
Several.
Several, yeah.
Several.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's you know, I have to admit that I can argue both sides of the street about whether he did a good thing or a bad thing, you know, but all of the people involved in research at the time, you know, he did a pretty bad thing for them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a child who's schizophrenic or has autism right now, he did a horrible thing mm-hmm. because otherwise that research would still have been completed.
Well, it's hard to know, isn't
possibly.
It?
Yeah, it's hard to know.
I mean, of course, he got all the young people involved, and which is exactly wrong. You know, he said that he only wanted to be two things. He wanted to be rich and
we're going to have to shut this door. Mm-hmm. And the last interview I did with you had a leaf blower in the background.
Right. Yeah, he wanted to be rich and he wanted to be famous. And so those were his two goals in life.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter to him how he became famous. I remember one time Alan Watts were in a group talking, and Tim was going to be doing this thing at Santa Monica Civic, and Tim kept wondering what he should have on the marquee, and Alan said, well, why don't you just tell him like it is, just say Tim Leary, the second coming. But you know, he really saw himself as the leader. And that he would, he would double-cross anybody at any time for anything if it was in his best interest.
Yeah.
He had no morals.
And you wound up spending a lot of time with him, really, between...
No, because he was, you could never have a conversation with him. And I said that to somebody one time, and they said, Tim never had a conversation with anybody.
Hmm.
Never.
He just talked.
Well, he would talk, change the subject, drink gin, you know, get pretty high, but he never talked.
Hmm.
He was very apersonal.
Hmm. Well, you know, maybe that's what changed at the end, And he did all this talking in the last 3 or 4 years, and that's why so many people are devoted to him today.
Oh, I know. There's so many people.
Well, I've received some pretty hateful email because I made a comment here or there about him. And
well, that's nice.
Well, yes, it's nice to know he can engender emotion. Yet, but no, I've decided to make a point of not make a point, but I'm not doing including any Leary stuff in all these podcasts. But there's so much Leary stuff out there. You can go dig that out. But I did see a video of the his archives. It's in 2 storage sheds. And 300 or 400 boxes, well indexed and cataloged, with every piece of paper that he's ever touched. His grade school report cards, everything. Mm-hmm. His death mask.
Yeah.
And which might have a few valuable pieces of paper in there. One of being is Myron, after he kicked him off the board of the Institute, said he never really had a good closure with it. So he came back and wrote a real long letter to him about what he was doing wrong.
Myron did,
yeah. But Myron doesn't have a copy of it anymore. So maybe he still exists in an archive, hopefully. I'd love to hear what Myron had to say.
Well, Myron wouldn't have said anything flattering, so the letter would have gotten burned.
Oh, now that's now that will be an interesting thing. Someday an archivist should pull that out. Yeah, do your kids still have any memories of those days? Do they ever bring it up?
The only thing, no, the 2 youngest don't. They don't remember, but the younger, the middle one, the little Buddha baby, we called her, and I remember when we got back to Dana Point, and we had a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house and a den and so forth, typical house in Dana Point, which is a tract house, and so Bess is so cute, she had these fat little hands, and so she woke me up in the morning. And I open up, you know, like, what, Bessie? Because we got back at like 2 o'clock in the morning or something, and she said, "Are we all going to live in this tiny little house?" And she went like this with her fingers, "This tiny little house." You know? She didn't remember the house. She just remembered the
Millbrook.
But,
well, you know, looking back on those days, from where I am now, I couldn't imagine taking my family around doing those things, but I did things like that with my family, too. Mm-hmm. We do things when we're younger that are just beyond our scope to imagine now.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, kids are very adaptable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, who else of that era, you know, the Aldous Huxley, Alan Watts, were there other psychedelic type luminaries that would come in and out of the world, or did you pretty much drop out of all that after you left Millbrook?
Well, after I left Millbrook, I guess I worked at the prison for a while. I think that maybe was the sequence. And then after that, I went to Hawaii and worked for Peace Corps. Yeah. And, I was always into adventure.
There's a lot of stories of people in the 60s that melted down and, you know, became, you know, wards of the state. I've never really heard anything that's documented. There's only one LSD crash I heard of, and it was one of the members of Pink Floyd. But did you encounter people who just went crazy and never came back after they took LSD?
No, I worked with some students as a psychotherapist. I would take them back, regress them to where they turned off during sessions, and took them back to that period of time, and then brought them forward and forward and forward. So I treated a number of people that had taken psychedelics that got stuck and remained stuck, but got them.
You could get unstuck.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and what about age groups? Right now there's, I don't think it's any different now than it was in the 60s. You know, there are kids in their junior high school that are taking LSD, and a lot of them with no guidance, no sitters, no nothing. Which I consider pretty dangerous, not so much from the physical standpoint as the emotional standpoint. Mm-hmm. You have any feelings about how old, does it make a difference if somebody is 15 or 50 or...
I think they have a better chance of getting into the experience the younger they are.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Aldous started... Was it Aldous who started saying that kids at a certain age should be given LSD?
Well, in Ireland, it's the moksha medicine, which was LSD.
Right.
So, I would say he was an advocate of that, at least in the novel. I don't know if I've read it anywhere else.
Well, but that was his...
Yeah. That was his platform. Yeah, as I recall, Island, there were certain periods in someone's life, but the first one seemed like at puberty is when the first time.
Right.
And
that's right.
With proper guidance, I still think that's a good method.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to bring this conversation to an end for now. From here, we just seem to kind of descended into a little gossip, a few personal stories from each of us, and probably way too much politics, just like everybody else's conversations. I guess what I'm getting at here is that I hope you're getting the feeling that these great heroes of early psychedelic research, people like Gary Fisher, Gene and Myron Stolaroff, Anne and Sasha Shulgin, they're all people that are much like you and me. Granted, they've accomplished things far beyond anything I can aspire to, but what I'm talking about is what they're like as people. You know, as you've most likely figured out by now, these wonderful folks are not all that different at their core from you and me. You know, ultimately, I think that this deep-seated awareness of the true commonality of our human experience is one of the great gifts of psychedelic experiences. I've not yet heard or read what I consider a clear definition of what it is that happens to a person once she or he makes a conscious intention to push their awareness beyond that psychedelic threshold, but as you well know, once you've had that experience... whether it was good or a bad experience, once you return from the realm of the other, well, I can't put it into words either, but as my friend Tony Rich once said, we do know what we know. And in a way, that can become a very slippery slope, but in the end, the one thing that keeps a psychedelic experience from morphing into just another organized religion of some sort is the fact that it is, in the end, an experience. Like Ken Kesey often said, you're either on the bus or off the bus. But the thing is that all of us guys who have decided to ride the bus have also continued to have a great deal of love and respect for those who choose otherwise. You know, in the end, everybody takes their own trip, and in my case, I've found that the love trip is much more enjoyable than its opposite, the fear trip. Now, that's a bad trip, don't you think? Well, what kind of a crazy hyperlink patchwork of thoughts got me from a conversation with Gary Fisher about the proper age for a person to have her or his first psychedelic experience to... love versus fear. I hope this lack of focus doesn't bode ill for the rest of the year, which, by the way, this is our third year in podcast land. That's right. Even though this is only podcast number 98, I am nonetheless in my third year of podcasting from the Psychedelic Salon. And for those who are joining us for the first time today, I hope you'll subscribe to this channel through iTunes, Google, Yahoo, or any of the other services. And that way you'll always be able to look back and download some of our earlier programs in addition to being notified of each week's new one. And if you want more information about this or any of our previous podcasts, just go to our Notes from the Psychedelic Salon blog, which you'll find at www.psychedelicsalon.org. And there you'll find links to books, papers, and other relevant information about our guests here in the salon. But our most important guest, I think, and I hope you'll agree, is you. You know, without you, well, I'd be sitting here talking to myself, I guess. Not that that's a bad thing, but it's so much nicer knowing that you're here too. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join me here each week. And in particular, I want to be sure to thank seven wonderful people who have truly warmed my heart. You know, for the past 2 years, on average, there have been about one person a month, a little bit more, who has made a donation to help pay the expenses associated with these podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon. And believe me, those donors have had a big influence on me, particularly at the times when I feel a little like slacking off. But I wasn't prepared for the fact that in the week that has gone by since the last time we were together here in the salon, there have been seven donors. That's right, seven. And several of them have made donations before, which is far and above the call of duty, you guys. So I hope everyone in the salon sends a little positive karmic energy out to these generous souls. And as always, my policy is to never reveal the full name of donors or email authors, just in case it might cause some issues back in the default world. So Albert C., David R., Corey H., Eugene R., Michael M., Brandon F., and Vipal P., or is it Vipal, V-I-P-A-L. New name for me, I like it. Anyhow, thank you all. Thank all of you so very much, and may all your days be merry. And now for a little sampling of a couple emails that have come in recently. Luke writes, I found your latest podcast, Energy Drinks and Other Stuff, to be particularly illuminating and synchronistic. After listening, I did a bit of research and found that the Halperin Gate and John Halperin ordeal tied in a bit closer to home than I expected. Growing up in Topeka, Kansas, my Little League football coach was Picard's attorney. I recall not being too fond of him, but in retrospect, I think it was the game, not the coach, that I was displeased with. I didn't have a positive Little League experience of any kind either, Luke. He goes on. Furthermore, I would frequently travel to, I don't know where this place is, Wamigo, W-A-M-I-G-O, Kansas, for disc golf festivals, and remember driving by the old missile silos that were apparently a key site to this unfortunate story. It's too bad that someone who looked to transform a symbol of American imperialism, missile silos, into beacons of next-generation consciousness is perceived as a social criminal. And then Luke goes on to say, unrelated to the energy drink podcast, I would like to thank you for the tremendous work you've done and the sincere positive ramifications it has had on my life. I view it as a privilege to have been able to listen to podcasts such as Reproducible Experiences on Different Entheogens before ever venturing into those spaces. Your resources have opened me up to ideas and philosophers whom I never would have found independently. I also received the following in an email from a saloner named Kat. You just gave me the biggest smile. I can't express to you how much I enjoy your work. I was listening while working on my computer, thinking how I would love to send you an email right when you expressed in your podcast that you'd never get email from women, laughing out loud. Then, of course, you realize that many women listen. So the delightful serendipity impressed upon me to write. Well, thank you for those kind words, Kat and Luke, but I assure you and all of the others who have written similar things that the privilege is all mine. And on top of that, I'm no different from you or any of the other saloners. Basically, when I hear something interesting, whether it's a talk at a conference or a good story a friend is telling, my first impulse is to share it with my friends. And my guess is that that's what you want to do too, so please keep in mind that all I am is a carnival barker, and all the action is in the tent. But I do have a lot of fun helping people find a few of the ideas they've been searching for a while. But ultimately, the only way any of us can thank any of the elders or great thinkers who have gone before us is to do the best that we can do to become a little more aware of the true nature of the magic that we're immersed in. You know, it's called the Earth Game, I think. And I also think we're about to advance to the next level. At least that's what I think on my bright and positive days, of which this is one. And I hope that today is a bright and positive day for you as well. And if it isn't, if this hasn't been your best day, well, why don't you try to find 5 minutes just before you drift off to sleep tonight and fantasize about your perfect day, your perfect life. Because, you know, without first having the thought, well, reality doesn't know where to go next. So press on, my friend, press on. And before I go, I also want to mention that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are protected under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 2.5 license. And if you have any questions about that, you just click on the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And if you have any questions, complaints, comments, or suggestions about these podcasts, well, just send them to lorenzo@matrixmasters.com. A big thank you again to Shatul Hayuk for the use of your music here in the salon. And my love and thanks go out to my dear friend Gary Fisher for being so kind as to allow this small intrusion into his privacy. Thanks a million, Gary. I really appreciate everything you've done for us, for all of us, your fellow humans. And for now, this is Lorenzo, signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.